Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Makwana Maja. So it is a sweltering hot day in Cape Town, so I apologize if I start to look a bit shiny for those of you watching on YouTube, but I will shoulder through nonetheless. What are we going to talk about today? Well, let's start off with probably the most important thing, that is the medium-term budget policy statement. This is sort of the halfway through the financial year update that government does to how its budget is going for the year. And Makone, I don't trust myself really to say it, but this seems pretty good. And let me just get into some of the details before I go to you for your thoughts on all of this. So this is, I think there's only relatively minor adjustments that are allowed to the actual budget, but the news from this is kind of good. So the bad news, I guess, is that economic growth remains slightly better than projections had it, but still very, very weak. The Deputy Finance Minister, Ashwell Sirupan from the DA, said that South Africa's economic outlook is on an upward trend, but economic growth is still only estimated at 1.8% per year expected over the next 3 years, which is just kind of, you know, really not even close to where we need to be to start making a dent in poverty and all the bad stuff. However, here's the good news. I'm reading here from the budget policy statement. Our optimism is rooted in the progress we've made in keeping out the promises we set. A promise to grow the economy faster, to strengthen public funds, and to improve life for all South Africans. 2 years ago, we committed to stabilizing public debt in the current year and then begin to reduce it. Despite the challenging environment of persistently low economic growth, we are on track to achieve this goal. And I just, it's like a challenging environment is a very good way of avoiding the causes of said challenging environment. But, let's not get bogged down on that. Debt servicing costs will be lowered by 4.8 billion rand. That means 4.8 billion rand more to be spent on things that we actually might want to spend it on. There was a primary budget surplus of 68.5 billion rand, or 0.9% of GDP. For the first time, we've had this debt has stabilized since 2008. So this is, you know, quite a big milestone, and I was skeptical that government would reach it, and it seems that they are proving us wrong, at least proving me wrong in this particular case. As a result of this surplus, there's going to be an additional 15 billion rand in spending over the next 2 years in the budget. The finance minister or the finance ministry said that they said that the reforms in logistics are gaining speed, that there's 2,200 megawatts of solar, wind, and battery projects in development, and more than 720 megawatts at advanced stages. I think that's about two stages of load shedding is 2,000 megawatts of electricity. They said that reforms in freight logistics are gaining speed, port efficiency is improving with vessel times down 75%, while container handling is faster. They said that just under 7 billion rand has been saved by closing or scaling down low priority and underperforming programs immediately. More than half of these savings come from identifying people who are double dipping and defrauding the social grant system. There's also been the beginnings of the audit into ghost employees in government, and they have already found just under 9,000, it seems, which is quite a staggering number, considering I think most of the audit is only supposed to finish in February. And Makwana, I'd like your thoughts on that when we come to it. But it really seems to me like, there might be a significant percentage of the entire civil service that actually doesn't exist as a ghost employee. So government debt will stabilize this year at 77.9% of GDP. As I said, the first time since the 2008 financial crisis. So that looks like some good stuff. Also, politically speaking, much less fighting over this one. It was seemed to be agreed upon beforehand. The DA was out touting the greatness of this medium-term budget policy statement. The ANC didn't have to postpone it. It was all kind of much more sort of civil. There is some bad stuff, like for example, they're expecting a 20 billion rands worth of tax increases in 2026. But this is sort of subject to change if SARS can actually raise the extra money. So it might not happen. McCorner, should we be optimistic?
I share in your careful optimism, Nick. I think Treasury specifically is one of those interesting formations to emerge from the GNU, because you have an ANC minister, you have two deputies, which I think, unlike other deputies, are actually not seat warmers. They actually do something. That's Mr. Ashraf Sarupen and Mr. David Masondo from the SACP. So you have the ANC, the SACP, and the DA collaborating at Treasury and, you know, making it work, and apparently successfully. And I also take into account, you know, the big event that happened earlier where we couldn't actually table a budget. I consider that to be a success and a strength of the GNU, that for the first time budgets are actually discussed, that opinions are weighed from people with different policy backgrounds and different policy leanings. I consider that first budget to be a success and a strength of the GNU, that we actually have now an environment that invites debate and invites discussion, where a minister is actually slapped down and goes back and revises his first budget and presents a new one. So I think, you know, this Treasury is a model for what the GNU could be, with better cohesion, better collaboration. And, you know, your careful optimism, I've noted in the beginning, I am particularly pleased that our debt is stabilizing. And I think in that regard, you're seeing the influence of the DA, which is represented by Ashraf Sarupen there, that there is this focus on curbing our debt-to-GDP ratio, which is in excess of 75%. That was long being, the sirens were being rang long before we even arrived, by the World Bank and the IMF, that it would cripple the government's ability to spend. And without spending, growth is hard to come by. So I'm very happy to see that we are actually going to stabilize our debt to GDP ratio. And that as a consequence of that, debt servicing costs, our maintenance of our debt, is going to come down, because at present, debt servicing costs are like top three expenditure line items of overall government spending, up there with things like health and education, which is a travesty. And that's why you're not able to see government make a lot of progress in terms of building infrastructure or contributing to things like gross fixed capital formation, building hard things, things of concrete, building more schools or more hospitals or more courtrooms. Or you're just not able to see government make that investment, because so much of our money goes towards, you know, servicing our debts. And so those two alone for me are a huge improvement and a big feather in the GNU's cap. One of the things I also take note of is the target, the inflation target. South Africa has a 3-6% inflation target, but Godongwana comes out now and says, we're actually lowering it and keeping it at 3% on our inflation target. And I was considering a report that was released just 2 or 3 months ago by the CRA into the stifling of the middle class, which is heavily burdened by debt in South Africa. There's one piece of information they share where they break down the middle class in terms of all different classes in South Africa in terms of different income bands, you know, starting from people who earn between 0 to 5,000 rands, and then from 5 to 10, from 10 to 2015, and on and on. And it showed that people who earn in the lowest income band between 0 and 5% are under like 90% of their debt is unsecured. So this is not debt that is used to buy cars or buy houses. There's no collateral with this debt. This is just unsecured debt. That tells you that people are dipping or relying on credit to, you know, support their monthly income shortfalls. And that's devastating, because those people are heavily crippled by that debt. And in order to pay that debt, they have to, you know, can't make certain payments to support their monthly expenditures. So to see that inflation target lower, that means borrowing costs will also become lower. And that's good for the middle class, which is all classes in South Africa, which are heavily burdened. But it's also good for companies, because companies can borrow for cheaper. And if they borrow cheaper, then they should be, that's one incentive at least to, you know, build factories,
Take
do
risks,
more,
basically.
take risks. Exactly. So I specifically noted that, and there's also the work that SARS and the role that SARS and Home Affairs are playing in this, which you highlighted in terms of the ghost workers that we have on our payroll, and that they make up a significant chunk of our civil service. That this collaboration between the Department of Home Affairs, our revenue collector being SARS, and Treasury has produced, this cohesive relationship where they're actually able to set targets and achieve them. And I think that's new in blood that's being injected into government by this GNU formation, where, people are coming together, different backgrounds, different policy ideas, but still being able to set priorities that supersede, party commitments and party alliances. So that for me is three big things that have emerged from this policy statement, this midterm budget policy statement that, the GNU can write home about. I do, however, think, and we discussed this before the show, that because what happens at Treasury tends to be not as political unless people are getting taxed more, unless income taxes are going up, that it can sort of fall under the radar. But I do think there's a lot of things here that are quite promising that we have to look forward to as South Africans if this behavior can be maintained, because there's a lot of projections about what we should stabilizing debt in the 2027, 2028 financial year. And I think those projections are incumbent and rely on the parties that we have at present, in Treasury specifically, those collaborations they have across with other departments or other ministries like Home Affairs. It depends on there being stability in those different areas that they can actually see through to achieving greater rates of things like growth.
So, apparently, one of the main reasons for this unexpected sort of improvement in our fiscal position is that tax revenue collection was higher. Particularly, it seems from consumers, things like VAT. And I think the big, so I've already seen sort of business leaders and things kind of, I think there was a piece in News 24 or something saying, has South Africa's pulled off the impossible? And there's this kind of narrative change that seems to be beginning, particularly among the business community, of everything's turning around now, and it's all sort of sunny uplands. The GNU is proving, that it was the right thing, and all of that. Some good stuff here, and this, it almost feels in some ways like finance is like a completely separate entity from the rest of government because it seems to sort of run by its own laws and perform much better. I mean, we're seeing some actual fiscal responsibility here, which is kind of crazy. But then you look at that growth rate, sort of 1.8%, and you go, that is cripplingly low. That is not the kind of thing that you actually now there's as per usual in the budget statement, the low sort of as the ANC's been doing every year since basically 2008, has been saying, well, the global situation is not conducive and global growth rates are dropping and all that sort of thing. It's like, okay, sure. But the real cause here is those major policy reforms, the difficult ones. Making the rails work a bit better, making the ports actually able to export raw materials we dig out of the ground is good, but it's not even close to the big reforms that are needed to get that growth rate higher towards the sort of 7-8% range where it needs to be. And I think the worry here that's been flagged by our boss, John Endres, Dr. John Endres, is that it's now's a really bad time to see complacency setting in. 1.8% is still abysmal. These numbers need to be much higher, and if they were much higher, our fiscal position would be in a much better place. So, let's take the win. Let's enjoy the fact that the country doesn't seem to be heading down the debt rails with no brakes. This is all extremely good news, but this is more like you've stopped the bleeding, but you haven't actually begun to heal the patient yet. I don't know, McCorney, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think that the government shouldn't be afraid to break a few things, and those are the big reforms that we're talking about. What you need in order to see high levels of growth, is beyond fiscal responsibility. I think you need to give a sense of confidence to the business community, because ultimately, even when you look at the ratios of who contributes the most to gross fixed capital formation or to like building of roads, of buildings, of factories, of office buildings, it's always the private sector outperforming the government. And one of the statements from FNB has been that our gross fixed capital formation is, what, 5.9% lower than its pre-COVID levels, that demonstrate that the business sector still has not felt confident enough to sink capital into South Africa. And so we're putting all the right pieces together, which you spoke about, you know, things like rail, things like roads, things like safety, which we're going to cover, policing, Transnet, you know, our ports, Transnet port terminals, you know. All of those pieces are being placed to create an environment that will allow the private sector to flourish, but it needs to go a step further. The review of things like the Expropriation Act, how do you possibly invite foreign direct investment when there's this constant looming threat that the government can at any point expropriate your property and even do so for less than what you are owed, less than below market value. Things like BEE and employment equity, which are just, of course, they're racially rigged, but they're also so difficult to navigate. The compliance levels of these laws, as Standard Bank has demonstrated, has resulted in them, not just these laws, but others too. We know that Standard Bank has 3,000 employees on its payroll just for compliance purposes, which makes up about 10% of their workforce in South Africa. When you take the rest of Africa into consideration, 5% of their workforce when you take the rest of Africa into consideration. Now, Standard Bank can have the wherewithal to do that, but companies from multinationals outside of South Africa are not going to have, you know, that sort of relationship in South Africa where you can just employ people because you like the country that much. That's not a sustainable business model. They're always going to weigh which country has the best offer for it and move there. And we want to make ourselves that destination. And so I agree with you that we are laying a path for engendering, you know, high levels of investment, solidifying and strengthening business confidence. But as and I affirm John's position, we need to go a mile more in order to really attract more investment and see investors pouring their money and sinking their capital into South Africa.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing I think that's been mentioned recently by Jonathan Oppenheim that we've covered is also just kind of overregulation in general of everything. You've got the sort of the corruption, the over-centralization, the racial laws, the destruction of property rights, and then you've also just got a massive amount of overregulating micromanagement. And that runs the entire gambit of the economy from, you know, where you can put up your street side stall to the biggest mine or factory or bank in the country. And that too also just cripples every kind of business you can think of. And until that stuff is just, you know, every single year the government will say, oh, we're going to slash red tape, but then doesn't actually do it because, you know, there's too many interest groups who are invested in the red tape. Until that nettle is actually grasped and ripped out, we're also going to really struggle, I think, to reach some of the numbers we could and properly begin making progress on unemployment and poverty. Okay, let's move on to our next one. All this comes at the time when the criminal justice system is just under ever-increasing scrutiny. It's already lost the faith of most South Africans. And now, with all the stuff coming out of the Matlanga Commission, it's only getting worse. Speaking to Parliament, the soon-to-be former the National Director of Public Prosecutions, Shamila Botoy, was testifying in Parliament before an ad hoc committee. She gave a very negative assessment of where the country was when it came to fighting crime. She said, Our crime is ravaging our country, and it seems like we are watching the movie in front of us in slow motion, and those of us in power that should be doing something about it are powerless to do anything about it. That criminals are taking over our country, organized criminals. We are not winning. The reality is we are not winning the fight against organized crime in this country. She was asked by an MP what specifically had been broken in the country resulting in this organized crime situation, to which she responded, "How much time do you have? I don't know where to start." She had also answered questions on a specific case where she had apparently alerted the president that there was a deliberate attempt to infiltrate the National Prosecuting Authority with criminal activities, to basically put in a prosecutor who was under the control of gangs. However, she refused to name said individual. She said that this was still, an allegation, and we didn't really know. She also said about the Zondo Commission that it hadn't been properly acted upon because it had not provided a blueprint for prosecutions, but rather leads that still needed some investigation. McCorney, in our pre-show discussion, you sort of mentioned that she seems kind of like she's in total despair. What's your take on all this?
That's the word I would use to describe her, as well as, and to add to that list, the president and the National Police Commissioner, Fanny Masemul. They just sound like people who have had, you know, specifically the National Commissioner, Fanny Masemula, and Shamila Batohi, they just sound like they've had the wind just knocked from beneath them. They do not inspire any amount of confidence. In fact, they break it. Like, after listening to her, I had been eagerly awaiting to hear from her and Masemula, as the top cop and the top prosecutor in the country. And
right, and she's retiring at the end of January, right? So, like, she doesn't have anything to lose.
No, she can break things as she's on her way out, particularly because this is the sort of platform where you want to do that. And you can see how, you know, parliament members are egging her on. You know, they were encouraging her, and it got a bit bullying-ish when they were like forcing her to reveal who this supposed prosecutor is who's got corruption allegations pending. So they invite her to show her teeth, and she has none. She seems to me like things just happen to her and to the NPA whilst she observes, and that she's got her hands tied behind her back. And I suspect this is like what Mkhwanazi was alleging, a problem of political interference. Which we also discussed briefly before the show, Nick, that I think that when people like Masemola and Batohi come into the job, there are so many areas they're actually not allowed to go into that they just end up sitting on their hands and sort of holding these jobs, but holding them symbolically, in that they're actually not able to effect much change or do anything. And then somebody below their rank, like a provincial commissioner, comes up because maybe he doesn't have those restraints, or he doesn't care, or has ulterior motives and even maybe personal ambitions. I don't know. So listening to her, and even when she was asked about the Gupta extradition, which for me was one of the biggest betrayals by the South African justice system, is that the people who are directly culpable for the breakdown of some of our most important institutions, including the justice system, by the way, the Gupta brothers, that their extradition was failed. And she was asked, well, what have you learned from that? And her response was to say, we're still reconciling ourselves with exactly what we failed at, or what went wrong. 2 years later, over 2 years later, actually, because this extradition was done it failed in 2023. And the NPA still doesn't know what went wrong. That means that should give you a preview into what to expect with the other Zondo state capture accused, right? And we've seen it. We've seen it with Brian Molefe. We've seen it with Koko Machela, where they're running circles around the NPA. And for her to resign and say, well, actually, the commission gave us leads, but it didn't give us evidence. They were organizations like OUTA putting together these cases. I think it's OUTA that actually, it's a book that I read by OUTA. It was written by a lady called Ilsa Salzwedel. And in that book, they provide, for example, the number of times different members of government visited the Gupta compounds because and they did this through a forensic search of the Gupta diaries through the Gupta leaks, right? Those Gupta leaks are damning. And for the NPA, whose job it is to investigate cases, to accuse the Zondo Commission of not doing enough to conduct those investigations, that's your job. That's where you come in.
Yeah.
You don't just come in with charges ready. You don't just come in ready to, you know, accuse them of different things. It's your job to actually investigate and uncover where the corruption is, where the crime happened. Just ultimate despair is the attitude that I got from her.
It's very frustrating to watch, and I do feel like maybe she's not being completely forthright about what some of the problems are. And as you say, political interference is probably one of them. But I remember Shamila Batwa being sort of quite widely praised beforehand. You could find lots of articles in the media and things saying, oh, she's going to be great. And it was like, okay, well, let's see. And now at the end of her tenure, I think we can say that that really didn't pan out. The most that can be said is that people will say, well, she stabilized the NPA from the Zuma years. So she didn't make it worse, I guess, is the claim. Okay, I mean, fair enough. but that doesn't seem like an enormous endorsement of a legacy, and that's putting it mildly. Okay, let's move on to our last story. This is one of the stories from Ground Up, who often report interesting little stories about the country that other media doesn't always get to. Midaroni Clinic, which is sort of west of Louis Trichardt in Limpopo, has been without running water since mid-2023. It serves a number of villages around, and this should be fairly simple to fix. There are three water tanks which are regularly filled, but the booster pump to pump the water to where it is needed does not work. Instead, the staff must fill buckets from a tap next to the tanks. Nurses use an inside toilet which they flush with buckets. They also fetch water for the delivery wards in buckets. The outpatient bathrooms have not worked for 2.5 years. Patients now use chemical toilets in the yard, which doesn't seem particularly sanitary. imagine sick people, particularly with diarrhea or something, having to use chemical toilets in the yard. Doesn't seem great. No toilet paper is provided, and there's nowhere to wash hands. The clinic is just in generally poor shape. Broken windows are patched with cardboard and the roof leaks. The clinic's committee asked the Vembe Health Department to provide a groundsman to help with the daily maintenance. 7 months later, they've not received a response. There's only one person who's assigned to do daily maintenance of the whole clinic infrastructure. And according to someone who works there, it is impossible for him to cope with the amount of work at the clinic. The ANC ward councillor said he had sent several letters to the Limpopo Health MEC and Vembe District Municipality, but had not received any response. Makone, you are currently in Limpopo, and you are currently without water.
And have been quite regularly since I've been. I've been here for maybe 2 months. And if you have a week without any interruptions, you're living the dream. If you have 2 weeks, then you're living in luxury. And also that the water pressure is maintained, then you're absolutely living in luxury. And I've been so infuriated by just the complacency that the people of Limpopo have resigned themselves to. It's like any other. And I'm not talking here about doing in the streets and burning tires and burning hospitals. No, I'm talking about real change, because Limpopo voted, I think, over 70% for the ANC in the last election. So we are now like the province that carries most of the ANC votes. And that has unfortunately come with a level of complacency and a lack of desire or a lack of inspiration to change things. Even I think of in the CBD in Polokwane, in the CBD, where, there are still a few law firms hanging on, a few, retailers hanging on by a thread. And even they have to use buckets of water every time somebody needs to use the toilet, open up the cistern, pour it, use the bucket, use the toilet and flush. And when I was reading this ground up article, I read that a Genosa representative, the union, described it as, being a difficult environment to work in. No, ma'am, this is hazardous. This leads to actual deaths. And
Yeah, you wonder
even
why
though
we occasionally have cholera outbreaks.
did we not learn anything from Royville? And I think what we need, Nick, is a death toll. I think we need to keep a death toll of all the people who have died at the hands of negligent service delivery. This is from, people giving birth on hospital floors, to children dying in pit latrines, to cholera outbreaks that have cost people their lives. I think we need a death toll. I
Yeah.
think perhaps that is what's going to shock people out of this complacency. And even out of this what I assume must be hopelessness, right? So I find this to be quite contemptible, and eagerly await for the next elections. I hope I won't be disappointed, but I think it's criminal what's happening in South Africa, that even as a middle class, we could do a lot more in demanding more from the government in terms of service delivery, which we don't. And again, I'm not talking about strikes. I'm not talking about national shutdowns. I'm talking about making your voice heard where it matters the most, which is at the ballot box.
Yeah. Now I'm eternally frustrated that there's a lot of South Africans will say, "Oh, democracy hasn't worked." Well, it's like, you're not using it fully. It is a very powerful and useful system, but you have to use it. And I mean, one of the depressing things though, and I think it would hit differently now. Remember that, when Thabo Mbeki left, well, was kicked out of the ANC. There was a published report on how many excess deaths were estimated to have happened because of his HIV/AIDS denialism. And they reckon it was 340,000 to 360,000. So that was one estimate. I mean, I don't know if that's how, how contestable that is or how defensible that is, but I think it's possible. I think it's plausible. And that, unfortunately, I think didn't, well, in that area, I guess, of health policy, we did, one of the very few areas in which Jacob Zuma actually excelled over his predecessor was much better HIV/AIDS policy, which is kind of ironic considering all the stuff he was famous for before he became president. So, yeah, I think something like that would be a useful thing to have in our public discussions. But unfortunately, I think also a lot of South Africans have almost kind of become numb even to death tolls. And so we sort of put them on the back burner, and that's a complacency. That's not even a complacency, but that's a sort of a mindset that needs to be destroyed if we're actually going to achieve a good country, to put it bluntly. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. So we started off good news, ended with bad news, which is unusual. Normally, we just either have bad news throughout or we end with the good news. But hopefully, for a change, we got to make people feel a little bit better about how things are going with our good news at the beginning. And we'll all see you tomorrow for the live show at 1:30. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.